Within just a few years, we will spend more on interest payments than we will on national defense. That is a bright flashing warning sign that we are on an unsustainable path. And clearly it is unsustainable because the fastest growing part of our budget is interest payments. And when you have a debt that's growing faster than your economy, obviously something will have to give.
To hear more about potential impacts of our increasing federal debt level, subscribe to PGIM's The Outthinking Investor in your favorite podcast app.
Pushkin. On this show, we have been asking for your questions, and you, the listeners, delivered. We got an absolute boatload of questions, way too many to ask them all. But today on the show, we try to answer as many as we possibly can. This is Unhedged, the Markets and Finance show from the Financial Times and Pushkin. I'm reporter Ethan Wu here in New York. And for this special listener question episode, I am joined today by the host of the FT's excellent narrative finance and business show, Behind the Money, Michaela Tsindera.
Hey, Ethan. Great to be here.
So Michaela and I are going to be co-hosting today, asking questions to our two esteemed Unhedged panelists. That would be markets columnist Katie Martin and U.S. financial commentator Robert Armstrong.
Greetings.
I hope we're going to know the answer to these things, because yes, listeners should be aware we haven't been given any cheats here.
This could be acutely embarrassing, Katie.
Well, Rob, for my part, I believe in your collective wisdom. Let's get started. So this first question comes from Joe Yao, who asked a bit of a curveball. He says, have you noticed that as the tech chip stocks have been booming, the snack chip stocks have also been booming, namely Utz? Do you guys know this company? It's like Utz?
Kate, let me ask Katie. Katie, as a person from the United Kingdom, do you know what an Utz is?
I have precisely zero idea what you're talking about. So this question is 100% one for you.
Utz is a very New York-y company that makes salty snacks. Until hearing this question, I was unaware that it was a publicly traded stock. I thought of it as a kind of a regional snack brand here. But they make a very nice potato chip. They make pretzels and things like that.
They also make Zapp's potato chips, which is a favorite in New Orleans.
Oh, right.
Maybe
on.
Some listeners might know those chips as well.
And the idea is that this stock has been going up lately. Is that right?
Yeah. This Utz stock, since October of 2023, it's up about 56%. So Joe's absolutely right. There is a little bit of a snack chip boom.
Okay. Is this because people have been listening to the Unhedged podcast and hearing us talk about chips? And so they run out and buy the only pure play chips company they could find, which was Utz.
You mock Rob Armstrong, but as you are well aware, this literally happens all the time. People mix up company names and buy stocks effectively by accident.
Yes. Cisco and Cisco being a classic example from the 2000s.
Fill us in, Rob, on the Cisco.
Well, there's
confusion.
Two companies. One is Cisco, and it makes computer networking equipment. It was a super hot stock in the dot-com boom. And the other is Cisco, a company that supplies restaurants and industrial kitchens with like huge cans of tomato sauce. And during the heyday of the Cisco company that makes like routers and what have you, a lot of people by mistake ended up investing in huge cans of tomato sauce, which is hilarious.
Well, so Rob, money where your mouth is. Long Utz or short Utz?
Jeez. Well, knowing nothing about the stock other than that I like to eat its product, if you owned it from the bottom and you're up 50% on a potato chip company, knowing nothing, my totally irresponsible answer to that question is sell.
High conviction calls here on the Unhedged podcast.
But at the same time, you know what Warren Buffett says, right? You know, buy stocks that you love. And if you love these salty snacks, stick with them.
Yeah.
Okay, our next question is from a listener named Robert Matthews, asking about India, pointing out that India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi faces elections in April, and China's still floundering. So they're wondering, Katie, Rob, Ethan, what's your take on India's bull run and whether it can continue?
So, I mean, I've gone for a number of years without anyone ever seriously mentioning Indian stocks to me as something that they are remotely excited about. And that has changed completely in the past sort of 3 to 6 months. As Robert Matthews, not Armstrong, very wisely points out, you know, the stock market there is doing great. One really big reason for that, And, you know, I'm not a geopolitical expert, but I'm here to tell you today that India is not China. And basically, anything that's in Asia that is not China is doing super well at the moment because people want a piece of emerging Asia. They want a piece of that kind of high growth thing, that manufacturing space, but they don't want the China political risk and all the rest of it. Indian political risk is seen as pretty muted, actually, despite the elections that are coming up. And so suddenly everyone I speak to seems to love India.
I think one part of this rally that's maybe less appreciated is that it's mostly being driven by Indian retail investors and a big influx of Indian retail investors into that market. India didn't really have COVID stimulus or handouts to ordinary people. So a lot of, you know, middle-class Indians with disposable income trying to protect their savings plowed it into the Indian stock market. And you've seen like a big increase in things like Indian brokerages reporting inflows and first-time investors coming online. That's potentially kind of a one-time thing. And, you know, I think when you have a huge wave of retail interest, there's always the possibility of froth and speculation and over-eagerness. So, you know, there's been a number of good pieces, especially in the FT, about there's all these like Indian small cap stocks that have gone absolutely ballistic. And that to me feels very like retail investor frothy. So, you know, I would not be surprised if there is a pretty significant correction in the next year or so in this market, just because there is so much enthusiasm that maybe can't last. But the underlying growth story is pretty good, I think, for the most part. It's demographics, it's capital accumulation, it's technological improvements, especially in the IT infrastructure in India. So that's real. But I would be like tactically short and maybe strategically long this market. Well, here is a technically marketsy question for you two. This is from Simon Hadanat. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, from Milan, Italy. Why is market cap calculated as the number of shares multiplied by the current value of one share, when we know very well that not everyone could sell their shares for, you know, the price that's listed on the market? That's a good question from Simon. Rob, why is that?
There's a difference between the value of a business and the value of a business if everybody tried to sell it all at once. So I think market cap is a good indicator. Multiplying the price of the stock, number of shares, that gives you a pretty good snapshot of what we think the market is worth today. The mere fact that in a fire sale, the value of the business would be a fraction of that doesn't actually tell you that much. I was indicating that I'm not certain about my answer by the fact that my tone rose at the end of the answer, in case you guys didn't catch that.
I mean, it's probably important to say there are other indicators of what companies are valued, things like enterprise value, where you instead of starting with what the market says your value is, you look at the company's balance sheet and you make a determination there. I mean, you know, I think any indicator, if you put it in an extreme scenario, it's going to seem a little ridiculous. But yeah, I think, Rob, your point's exactly the right one. The point is that people are not always trying to sell. You know, they're not trying to liquidate. A lot of companies will be worth a lot less if you tried to liquidate them.
And on the other hand, if you tried to buy all the shares all at once, you would pay more, which is what happens when a takeover happens. If somebody shows up and says, we'll take all the shares now, please, they usually have to pay like 25% more. Yeah. So there's a difference between these kind of markety liquidity. Can you really buy it? Can you sell it? And what is the value of the business?
Yeah, I would say it's one of these kind of measures that's not perfect, but it's kind of as good as it can be. This is just like, I can't think of a better kind of shorthand way to do it. So it will persist. But it's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought about it before.
All right. Well, we have a question from a listener named Christy Ilias. She wrote in and shared how she's part of a union here in the US that's for theatrical mechanics and engineers. So she works in show business, and her union was impacted by the Writers and Actors Guild strikes last year. And now she's thinking ahead to the next round of union negotiations. And she's wondering what keeps a company from picking up and leaving the U.S. and going to a country that doesn't have a union. In essence, her question is sort of what keeps companies in America?
Well, I don't know if she's looked at like European employment law recently, but there's a lot. You know, it's infinitely more difficult to lay people off in the UK and in Europe than it is in the States. So from from a worker's point of view, that's great. From a company's point of view, that makes life a lot more difficult. So, you know, yes, there is obviously a rise in, you know, employment, like unionism in the States. Sitting from our side of the Atlantic, we're like, well, duh, of course you need some protections, you need some kind of collective action ability. But you can still, as a company, get away with a lot more in the States than you can elsewhere.
I sense an Armstrong American exceptionalism rant coming.
Don't push this onto me, Ethan. You're the best educated in economics of the three of us. Tell us why every company doesn't just do a Jack Welch and put its business on a barge and move it to whatever is the cheapest domicile for labor with the least rules for protect labor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, companies definitely do that, right? Like, that's been a big part of, like, the so-called China shock and jobs moving to Vietnam and Bangladesh and, you know, or Mexico or Canada out of the U.S. But, okay, what keeps companies in the U.S.? Like, look at the labor productivity numbers, right?
Correct.
Yes, you have to pay U.S. workers a lot, but they produce more per worker hour than workers in a lot of other countries. Maybe that has to do with the work culture. Maybe that's because it's easier to hire and fire, so you get better matching between employers and workers. You could have an argument about why exactly that is, but U.S. workers are often better, even though they're expensive. So you're paying up, but you're really getting something for it.
Collectively, they're the most productive workers in the world. I think we can say
hesitation.
Yeah.
And certainly the most productive given the size of both the labor force and the domestic market. So if you're a company, you can set up in the U.S., get some of the world's most productive workers, and you can sell not to some, you know, European or some Chinese person across the world, but just to someone in the next state. There's a huge internal market. And I think that, alongside the productive labor forces, are like the big draws to America.
There was also an argument made during the pandemic that a lot of companies learned that having long supply chains had costs they weren't aware of before. So It used to be that all this stuff would move seamlessly around the world and it was no problem. And then that stopped working, and suddenly it's like, where's my washing machine or whatever? So I'm actually not sure how true that argument is going to turn out to be. It may be that, like, yeah, we had a bad 8 months getting the parts, the widgets we needed or whatever, but the fact is they're cheaper when they make them over there in China, and so we're going to keep doing that. But that's one to consider, that actually there is risk associated with moving people, goods, and services around the world.
I'm curious on this, Ethan, is there any differentiation between skilled and unskilled laborers as well? I mean, I assume Christie falls into the quite skilled labor bucket here, being part of a theatrical mechanics and engineers union. Does that come into play as far as where companies decide to set up?
You know, I can't say I've looked at the data quite granularly enough to say definitively. But I guess what I would say is, I think on the educated part of the spectrum, it's hard to substitute away from U.S. skilled labor, whether that's mechanics or that's, you know, like computer scientists, tech workers, creatives. That part of the labor force seems relatively sticky. Where you have had less stickiness historically in the U.S. is at the lower skilled end of the spectrum. But I think post-COVID, that's even been changing a little bit, that, you know, we've now seen that there seems to be a structural labor shortage in the U.S. We can't get enough of workers of all kinds. And for a while, there was a pretty big wage premium for lower skilled workers who wanted to switch jobs simply because we didn't have enough of them. So I think even the story here is kind of changing. And I don't know where it's going to balance out in the long run. But I think the labor market in the U.S. has changed absolutely radically, and it's really benefited people at all skill levels in the last couple of years.
Of course, this question is very politically live. There is a big political fight going on, not only in the United States, but worldwide, about who has globalism helped and who has it hurt. And clearly, the outsourcing of jobs is part of that story. But basically, every paper I have ever read about this comes to the conclusion, think a little less about your job being replaced by someone in another country, and think a little more about your job being replaced by a machine. The majority of economic dislocation in terms of employment in the United States has been technology driven. So, you know, if we brought all the manufacturing jobs back from China at this point, it would be like 4 jobs. Like, who's going to press the button to get the factory started? So I would, you know, just as a last point, might want to reframe the question towards technology rather than outsourcing or job flight.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment with more of your questions.
Liquid alternatives can offer some substantial diversifying returns, not only in a 2022 world where traditional asset classes are challenged, but also during a world where you have only a few asset classes delivering on their expected returns, and therefore you need some genuine diversification within your portfolio.
To hear more about managing risk in the face of uncertainty, subscribe to PGIM's The Outthinking Investor in your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back. I was glad we got this next question because this is one that we don't do quite enough, and I think Rob will have some very strong opinions on. This comes from Akash Janey. I have a question for Rob for the listener Q&A episode. What does Rob think about Gen Z's sense of style or fashion, and how does he see that changing as they enter the labor force?
Jeez. Well, first, let me just state as a blanket statement that I despise the young. And so I hesitate to approve of anything that young people do. Having made that blanket statement, I will say I don't see any difference in my workplace or when I'm walking around Midtown Manhattan. I don't see that much difference at this point between how the relatively old and the relatively young in the workforce dress, actually. As I've noted in my weekend column before, casualization has won the war. We all get to kind of wear whatever we want to work now, and that's what people are doing, for better or worse.
Yeah, I mean, I remember you writing lots of columns years ago about how everyone should keep wearing ties.
No, I tried. I lost that fight.
You have lost
battle. It's over. It's all over. So now we're in a world where anybody, there are no rules, and everybody gets to do whatever they want. And whether that's a good world or a bad, and that applies to the Gen Z, Gen X, baby boomers, everybody is playing in this sartorial free-for-all. And I actually think, you know, it won't surprise anyone to hear me say, I think that's a bit regrettable, not because everybody should be wearing suits and heels or anything else, but just because it's actually quite hard for people to know how to present themselves in different kinds of situations when there are no rules. So when there was a semi-uniform before, I think it took the pressure off in a certain way, whereas now, who knows how we're supposed to dress or behave. So there's much to be regretted here.
I will note that I think the craziest, like most Gen Z outfits all happen online, right? It's
yes.
The people that are doing crazy outfits for TikTok and then take them off and change into, like, you know, jeans and a t-shirt to actually go out in the real world. So for people that don't have a lot of Gen Zers in their life, but who are watching them online, I feel like they may have possibly a distorted view of how crazy Gen Z gets with things. The one change I will notice, and this is maybe broader than Gen Z, is loose clothes are super, super back, I feel like.
You
know,
true.
The skinny jeans are on their way out. People are wearing back to mom jeans.
Yes.
Gotta love the mom jeans. But I do remember when I got my first ever grown-up job, I had to go out and buy like a suit, which is just like stupid. There's just no reason why, you know, graduates with no money should be cobbling together whatever pennies they can find to buy a suit of all things to go to work.
I agree with you. That is a step in the right direction.
I think that's probably a good place to wrap up the episode. Apologies to any listeners whose names we butchered. We did do our best. And sorry we couldn't get to all the questions. There were so many. We really liked hearing from you guys. And you are, of course, always welcome to email the show, ethan.wu@ft.com. But for now, Michaela, thank you for being the co-host for this episode.
Of course, anytime.
Listeners, if you want to hear more from Michaela, myself, Rob, and Katie, we have done a bonus episode over in Michaela's feed, Behind the Money from the FT, where we answer a different chunk of questions. So if you cannot get enough of your own questions, please go listen to Behind the Money. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon. Unhedged is produced by Jake Harper and edited by Brian Erstadt. Our executive producer is Jacob Goldstein. We had additional help from Topher Forges. Cheryl Brumley is the FT's global head of audio. Special thanks to Laura Clark, Alistair Mackey, Greta Cohn, and Natalie Sadler. FT Premium subscribers can get the Unhedged newsletter for free. A 30-day free trial is available to everyone else. Just go to ft.com/unhedgedoffer. I'm Ethan Wu. Thanks for listening.